Hey folks, it's Charlie here. This is the 50th Coast of Story. I know, I can't believe it either. Just wanted to nip in and say thanks to everyone who's listened, whether this is your first one or whether you've been here since the start. I do really appreciate it, and here's to the next 50. And you can, of course, help celebrate the occasion by buying the podcast a pint. There's a link to the donation site to do just that in the show notes. And it is, of course, a roundabout way of buying me a pint without me actually saying that. But anyway, without further ado, here's Coastal Stories 50. And here's me about to tell you that this is a coastal story. This is a coastal story, written and presented by Charlie Connolly. We'll never know what possessed Hans Siversen to steal a bale of cotton from the hold of the American brig Eliza in the dockyard at Plymouth that day in the summer of 1811. Maybe it was a spur-of-the-moment thing. Maybe he was working on the ship, saw the bale, saw his chance. A decision made in the blink of an eye, a decision with repercussions that would resonate down the rest of the century. A decision whose ripples would reach the far side of the world. The Eliza was Bounty, an American ship sailing from Philadelphia for Bordeaux with a hold packed with 130 bales of cotton and dispatches for the American ambassador to Paris. It was a risky voyage as the British were blockading French ports, and sure enough, the Eliza was chased down and captured off Ireland by the British ship Medusa. Since then, the Eliza had been moored at Plymouth for weeks, waiting for a buyer. Maybe Hans Siversen found work looking after the Eliza, saw the cotton and thought, well, it's just going to waste there, in the hold, nobody coming for it. It's basically stolen goods anyway. And they won't miss one bale. I could get a decent price for that. His fourth daughter had been born a few months earlier, and it was becoming a struggle to feed them all. He didn't take it on his own. When caught, he was with a man called Shamgar Hewitt. Maybe he'd needed someone to help lift it out of the hold. Maybe it was Hewitt's idea in the first place. Maybe he and Hewitt had been working in the hold. Hewitt decided to steal the bale, asked Hans to give him a quick hand getting it up the ladder, and Hans just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Either way, in August 1811, Hans Siversen appeared at Plymouth Assizes, was charged with larceny, found guilty, and sentenced to death. He was about 36 years old, Norwegian-born but living in Plimstock, now an eastern suburb of Plymouth. Married to Rebecca, known to everybody by her middle name Anne, with four daughters, Garina, Elizabeth, known as Betsy, Severina and Sibylla. Betsy was 9 years old when she learned her father had been caught stealing. She was still 9 years old when he was sentenced to hang. For 9 years she'd been just a normal girl from a poor family. Plimstock was all she knew. The moment her father stole that bale of cotton, it changed Betsy Siversen's destiny, along with everyone else in his circle. Betsy's destiny, though, would be quite something. There were a few agonising days while Hans sat contemplating his mortality in prison in Exeter, waiting to hear if his death sentence might be commuted, or whether he was truly bound for the noose. Eventually news filtered through to Plimstock that Hans would not be hanged. He would instead be transported to Australia.
for life. At the end of October 1811, he was moved from Exeter to Portsmouth and placed on a prison hulk named Captivity. After 7 months, including a full winter, on the damp, cold, fetid and rotting hulk, in May 1812, Hans Siversen was taken in chains and put aboard a square-rigged, three-masted ship of 500 tons called the Indefatigable, along with more than 200 other convicts, and set sail for Van Diemen's Land. This was the first convict ship ever to sail direct to Tasmania. And alongside the Indefatigable was the Minstrel, carrying 127 women prisoners to the same destination. The Indefatigable docked at Hobart in October, after a voyage of nearly 5 months. 2 months later, the ship sailed on to Port Jackson, now part of Sydney, and Hans was still on board. Maybe his experience as a sailor was felt to be of more use in Port Jackson, whose harbour was getting busier all the time. Back in England, Betsy tried to reconcile herself to never seeing her father again. He might as well have gone to the scaffold, she thought. There's still the same gap, the same absence in their lives. She didn't know where Van Diemen's Land was, just that it was far away, a place from which her father would never return. He was gone from their lives forever, leaving a household of 4 young girls and their mother. How on earth would they survive? Betsy's mother was thinking very differently. For days after his conviction, she tried to come to terms with his imminent death. Then he was spared. As long as he remained alive, Anne Siversen was determined to see her husband again. On New Year's Day 1815, with Betsy just turned 13, she, Anne, Gorina, Severina and 4-year-old Sibylla sailed from Portsmouth on the Northampton, a ship that was taking 200 female convicts to Botany Bay, along with a handful of wives and families joining husbands and fathers already there. They sailed as part of a government scheme by which selected prisoners' families could travel free of charge on convict ships and join their prisoner in Australia. The scheme was seen as a way of redressing the gender imbalance in the colony, as well as providing an incentive for good behaviour among the convicts. It also eased some of the burden on parish relief, with many families left destitute once the husband or father had been transported. It wasn't a pleasant voyage on the Northampton. 10 women and children died on the way, 3 from the same family, and 1 woman had to be confined to a strait waistcoat for large sections of the journey. Off Madeira, the Northampton was attacked by an American privateer, but eventually allowed on its way when the Americans decided they were dissatisfied with the cargo. Betsy, the girl who had never been further than Plymouth in her life, would have seen the wide, endless horizon of the Atlantic. Sunrises and sunsets over the sea. At Tristan da Cunha, an albatross flew with the ship for a while. Then there were 2 weeks at Rio de Janeiro. She likely suffered dreadfully with seasickness, as most of the passengers did when several days of storms followed the vessel around the Cape. There were more storms in the Pacific and on the last leg of the voyage along the Bass Strait, so it was a bedraggled complement of convicts and families who finally docked at Port Jackson after 6 months at sea. The Siversons would have been grateful for solid ground. We can only imagine Betsy's joy at seeing her father for the first time in 4 years. He must have looked much older than she remembered, even allowing for the basic passage of time. His months on the hulk, the voyage, after 3 years of working under a hot sun. That would age anyone. But imagine the joy in his eyes when he saw his family for the first time, who had left everything they knew to sail halfway around the world to join him, in a world unimaginable to any of them before he took the fateful decision to steal that bale of cotton. The squeals of his girls, the smile of his wife, the tears of all of them. Life was hard in the early days of Sydney. The Siversons had 3 more children there, none of whom lived past the age of 4. Anne died giving birth to a stillborn son in 1823, 2 years after Hans had suffered a terrible injury, falling from the rigging in a storm while working on the Lady Nelson, a cutter charting the coast around Port Macquarie in Tasmania. A broken femur left him lame and unable to work, an injury serious enough for him to be given a conditional pardon from his sentence in order that he might find another way just to make a living. But life for Hans was a struggle after that fall. His leg took almost a year to heal, and even then left him unable to do physical work. Letters survive, written for him by somebody else as he could neither read nor write, begging with increasing desperation for work. In July 1823, for example, the lame, recently widowed ex-convict writes to the colonial secretary that Hans Siversen showeth that your memorialist, having served many years on Her Majesty's colonial vessels in the capacity of an officer, and in his duty having met with injury on board the Lady Nelson, breaking his thigh, together with a large female progeny, destitute by the loss of an amiable mother just a few weeks back. Your memorialist, from his long residency and thorough knowledge of the maritime duty required in the colony, humbly solicits to be appointed to a situation, and his preferment to such situation, his constant and most strenuous endeavours by due attestation for his duty, shall be unremitting. There was no reply. He kept trying. By 1825, approaching 50, he was reduced to begging for work, any kind of work, on a prison hulk called the Phoenix, one notorious for its rebellious inmates and terrible conditions. But still, nothing. By then, Betsy Siversen was 23 years old, watching Sydney grow rapidly around her. She'd also found both a route to happiness and a way to help her father. In 1824, Betsy had married James Crossfield Curry, a London-born seaman on his way to becoming a master mariner, a man with prospects. A man who not only made Betsy his wife, but took in her father too, to live in his home close to Sydney Harbour. For the first time since that day in far-off Plymouth in 1811, Hans Siversen's luck had finally changed, even just a little. One captured ship, one bale of cotton, one fateful decision. It had taken Hans Siversen to the other side of the world, and it had taken his family there too. His role in the story, triggered by that single bale of cotton, was coming to an end. Betsy Curry's was only just beginning. That was A Coastal Story, and I'm Charlie Connolly. Thanks for listening to the 50th episode of Coastal Stories. This is part one of that story. The second part will be along next week. Thanks also to everyone who's been listening to all these tales, whether you've been on board, so to speak, since the start, or have discovered the podcast more recently. Your support and encouragement are what keep this thing going. And hopefully we'll keep going until we clock up the 100, and then some more. If you could spread the word, on Twitter, Facebook, by actually talking to people with your mouths. I would really appreciate it, because the more listeners, the merrier. Don't forget, you can find us on Twitter at Podcast Coastal, at Podcast Coastal, and we're on Facebook too. Just search for Coastal Stories Podcast. The waves you can hear, they're not just in your head. They were recorded on the beach at Deal, in the sunshine, on the afternoon, at high tide, on July 1st, 2021.